When one door opened, the other door closed. Some kind of mist will go across the door. We asked him what it was. He told us that it was a disinfectant, as we would call it. One moment there was a wall, the next it was an open door. I could see no hinges or handle, not even a joint where the door met. After we had entered the compartment and the door had closed behind us, our guide told us we had to remove our clothes so the disinfecting process would be effective. Mike and I were both a little nervous about taking off our clothes in front of these people, but felt a little better about it when we saw that we would get to wear some of their clothing. I was glad we had both taken baths the night before. I was looking around for light bulbs or fixtures or switches, but there was nothing on the walls or ceiling. There weren't any shadows, either. The light just seemed to come from everywhere at once. After we had dressed in their clothing, which opened at the back like one of those hospital gowns, we passed into another compartment which contained some kind of haze that went over our entire bodies. They had given us some light jackets to put on that, compared to any clothing we had ever seen, were just beautiful. They were made from a material of a very slick texture, and, when the edges of the fabric were brought together, they attached themselves without buttons. When the inner door eventually slid open, we came into what must have been their main compartment. The first thing I noticed was their chairs. They were wonderful, just out of this world. Our host invited us to sit in these great chairs, which were completely adjustable, though the travelers were also similar to each other. I am certain one size of chair would fit them all. Like the ship itself, they didn't seem to have any individual parts. A force of some kind made them move toward you when you were about to sit without anyone appearing to touch them, and Mike had a great time trying to outwit the chairs, to the great amusement of our friendly hosts. When I sat, the chair subtly and automatically adjusted to fit and support my body from my heels to my head. A screen measuring about 5 by 4 feet appeared, showing pictures of a place or process that the boys simply could not fathom. Opposite the screen were other types of machine, described as magnetic sensors. Their meals and the cooking thereof are impossible to explain, although they were very nice about trying to explain it to us. We saw what I would call sleeping compartments with unusual beds, but we asked no questions about their sleeping customs. The toilet facilities were fully automatic. Things like towels and toilet tissue were not there. It all seemed to be operating by the magnetic force, or maybe some chemical reaction. The largest room we saw was their laboratory or workshop. I saw many different things I could not even begin to grasp, though I tried to ask some questions about these machines. The men replied that, no matter how they explained it, it would be impossible for the boys to understand any of it. "Why do you keep coming to our valley?" asked Mike. "We study the life patterns," came the simple reply. Although the inside of the craft couldn't be seen from outside, from the inside everything was visible. We could see clearly through to the outside and observe clouds in the darkening sky, Leo explained. We called it glass, but they informed us it was some other type of material which they did not explain to us. Also, images of real-time scenes could be projected from anywhere onto a screen, evidently imagery being fed in from their sensor systems. When I interviewed Leo at his home in Helena, Montana, in 2004, he revealed more. There's a screen on that panel that shows the entire world, like a map, but it's different, he said. As they travel, the information keeps changing. No buttons are used, it's done by brain waves, via the eyes, for example. 9. Another of their abilities that we experienced inside that spaceship is just as baffling, Leo reports in his book. I sat in one of those wonderful chairs watching the sun go down over the mountains outside and listening to one of our hosts trying to explain something about how far away their galaxy is. Next thing I knew, we are walking on the hillside and he was showing us how the grasshoppers lay their eggs under the dirt. Just like that. I blinked my eyes and there we were, back with the galaxy lecture. Blink again and he was showing us how the magnetic laser beam worked. They could also stop a bird in flight and hold it motionless in midair. Now I saw this done, but I am not sure how. They could catch a rabbit in his jump and stop him in midair, and they could hold these animals like this for minutes or hours. Then, suddenly, they could just release them. In other words, from the understanding we gained, they had the ability to stop any moving object at any range they desired. Our military men should take note. These people who we met and talked to in the year 1932 came right out and told us they had traveled to this planet for over 5,000 years. They will continue coming to this planet because it is their responsibility. It is important for us to understand that they said the Earth is their responsibility, rather than mankind's. We were told that they will continue traveling to our planet, to this very spot, and to many other places as our world gets deeper into trouble. One of the reasons for their great intelligence is their ability to use 12 senses. And they told us that 12 people from their galaxy live full-time on our planet Earth. These people live among us, but we cannot tell that they are different from us. We were also informed that these 12 people have often offered to help our world and were rejected every time. Leo related to me some amusing anecdotal information he acquired that year from a native Indian chief. "They come from the heavens," declared the chief. "They're white, and they dress funny. We got down on our knees to them. They taught us how to plant things. My granddad told me all these things, which he'd learned from his father. They came by season. Then, when the white men came, we originally mistook them for the people who had come from the heavens." 10. Further contacts. Further landings and contacts took place occasionally over the years. I saw the spaceship off and on after that first year, and even saw it land several times, wrote Leo. Mike was not present at these events. In 1933, I had the pleasure of seeing it landing about 2 miles south and a mile and a half east of Dunn Center, North Dakota. It continued landing at that location from 1933 to 1934. In August of 1936, about the end of the month, around 9:45 in the evening, I again saw their ship land at the location near Dunn Center and decided to walk up to them. As I approached the ship, I was allowed to enter through their magnetic forces. The ship didn't look any different from the ship I'd seen in 1932. I was welcomed by three people and was certain they were the same people I had met back in 1932, and I did not have to ask to enter their spaceship. They said the world would have many problems, but they would not interfere, and reaffirmed that this planet was their concern, that man has his own mind, and that he must learn to take care of his planet if he wants to keep his home. He assured me our planet would continue to exist, but I was not assured that man would continue to exist on it if he did not learn to take better care of his most valuable possession. In October 1936, Leo enrolled as a laborer with the Civilian Conservation Corps, CCCA, Public Work Relief Program for Unemployed Youth during the Great Depression, receiving an honorable discharge in March 1937.11. There were no further contacts until 1938, at Watford City, North Dakota, close to the Missouri River Bridge. Then, on the evening of September 15, 1939 at around 21:30, as he was en route to Watford City, a spaceship landed about 300 feet off the side road. Two men, identical to those from the previous encounters, alighted and greeted Leo. Expressing their pleasure at seeing him again, they added that he had changed a lot since 1932. Leo said he was bemused that they, on the contrary, had not changed at all. "We are several thousand years ahead of your time. We are germ-free and our life expectancy is quite different from yours. At this time, it would be impossible for us to explain to you how we have accomplished all this in our lives. But we can assure you, if your scientists would devote their time to increasing your lifespan, people on Earth would be capable of living in good health much longer than you do now. In your looking very well, The Surprising Nature of Getting Old, Faber, 2010. Author Lewis Wolpote states his belief that one day human beings may have a lifespan of 600 years. Leo was puzzled to note that, although it was now about 10 o'clock at night, the area around the spaceship was not dark. Some type of glow kept shadowless light in the area, he observed, as Barry Potter pointed out succinctly to me. The alien light is always described as shadowless, which is directly contrary to our understanding of light as a radiant effect, that is proceeding in a straight line from source to a reflecting surface. 12. I concur. Additional evidence for this technology is provided later, particularly relating to the Amicizia saga, chapter 13. Hit the 12th of November 2016, asking if they were worried about people noticing the glow. Leo received an interesting reply. We have stopped all movement for 3 miles around us. There is no way that anything can move within that area. No person can approach the ship unless we allow them in trance. It will be some time, well in the future, before people will be able to understand and do much, if any, of what we are capable of doing now. This new understanding will make a tremendous change on your planet Earth. Leo was invited aboard, involving the same disinfection process and change of clothes as before. 6 men, seated in the main compartment, were watching an image on a large TV-like screen, which Leo learned was of their galaxy. Again, he marveled at the lack of any visible light fittings in the ship, and inquired how the light was generated. "Our lighting system is in our metal," he was told. "The power for our machines is also generated in our metal. This is all we can tell you, for it would be impossible for you to understand how our energy system works." By around 23:30, Leo felt it was time to leave. The first man put his hand on my shoulder. After hesitating for a moment, I put my hand on his shoulder. In turn, I did this with all 6 men. After I entered the outer compartment, I removed the jacket and handed it inside to them. The door closed and again the mist covered my entire body. As I finished dressing, the unusual door opened and I stepped out of the spaceship. Heading back to the car, Leo was astonished to find his way illuminated in some way by the same shadowless light all the way to his car. In 1941, Leo was called to service with the U.S. Navy and eventually participated in the invasions of Okinawa and Iwo Jima. Most of this period was spent with the amphibious unit in the South Pacific, serving, for example, in the minesweeper USS Skirmish, AM-303. He also served in the USS Missouri, witnessing the surrender of Japan to General Douglas MacArthur on that ship. I surmise that he probably served with either the Office of Naval Intelligence or Office of Strategic Services, though he never confirmed as much, as he was involved, for example, with the occupation force in Japan, interrogating prisoners, and also served in Africa, 13, mostly related to counterintelligence. Following the war, Leo moved to Bozeman, Montana, working as a salesman, returning to Kadir in 1948. In 1950, he saw a spaceship landing in the high hills along the highway between Norris and Sappington Junction, some 30 miles from Bozeman. He planned his business trips so as to pass through that area regularly, in the evenings, and observed the craft on a number of occasions. Because the ship was usually well back from the highway in very difficult terrain, he explained, "I had no real chance to make a personal contact with them." Leo does not provide dates of these events, but it is worth noting here that on the late afternoon of April 12, 1950, in Helena, some 65 miles from the landing site described by Leo, a Mrs. Ida Welch reported an object that looked like 2 soup plates put together, larger than a bomber, flying so close to the ground that anyone could have shot it down with a rifle. 3 months later, 5 Helena residents in different locations reported an object, described variously as cigar-shaped, a flaming disc, or wing-shaped. 14. Sadly, Leo's younger brother Mike was reported killed in action in 1950, during the Korean War. In 1962, while driving with his 3 young daughters and 2 of their friends at Sappington Junction, Montana, Leo saw a spaceship moving through the evening skies. Perhaps this was an ideal opportunity to secure supportive evidence. It was difficult to pick my way over the dark mountain roads, but finally I drove my car within about 200 feet of the spaceship. It was hovering about 20 feet off the ground, producing all the colors I had witnessed before. It was very hard to contain my disappointment when I saw that the girls, were all frightened. There was no way to convince them no one would hurt us. We watched the ship for only about half an hour. Several times, I flashed my headlights at them, certain they knew the girls were with me and were scared. I was convinced it was the same spaceship I had seen back in 1932 and again in 1939, and had no doubt that the same people were aboard. In 2010, Leo's only surviving daughter, Frances Dershak Hankinson, provided a testimonial to this event for me. "The only experience that I have had with UFOs is when Dad took me, my two sisters, and two of their friends over to Sappington Junction. It was late evening. He told us there was something he wanted us to see. He parked out in the middle of nowhere, and had us watch the sky for lights. It was getting late and darker and we wanted to go home. When we spotted lights in the sky, to the best of my recollection, the lights were auburn, green, and yellow. The lights were flashing but stationary. Dad flicked the headlights in their direction, and they repeated the same pattern back at him. He did this several times, then it was gone. I have never seen anything like it since." 15. One summer's evening in 1963, Leo was driving from Ennis to Sappington Junction when he spotted a craft in the process of landing in the foothills about 6 or 7 miles off the main highway. He stopped the car to watch. Another car drew up and a couple got out and confirmed what Leo was seeing. He then asked the man to follow him, planning to drive as close as they could, then walk the remaining distance to the ship. The man refused, explaining that he'd experienced a close encounter with a craft in California which had alarmed him. While driving through the same area on the evening of October 21, 1963, Leo decided to try to initiate another contact. At around 20:15, he parked his car and set off on what he guessed would be a very long walk to the landing site. Arriving in the vicinity, he could see the ship, parked down a rugged slope. When I was about halfway down, I noticed the area around the spaceship was lit up with the soft, indirect light I remembered so well. I could see about 6 people moving about on the ground. As I came closer, I saw 2 of them were moving my way. The men greeted Leo enthusiastically in the same manner as before. They confirmed that they had monitored him, for instance, during his experience with the couple in the car. "You should have known, after all these years," they said, "that most people will not believe you. But this time was different. This man knew of our existence. He had seen us before. But, had allowed his fear to convince him that we are a threat." On board the craft, sitting in the extraordinary chairs, a lengthy discussion ensued. Part of the information on board referred to attempts by our military to capture one of the alien ships. "Your science and technology have advanced enough to pose a threat to our ships, as well as to the entire planet. If your military leaders continue their efforts to damage our ships, we will be forced to defend ourselves. Our actions to protect and defend ourselves are governed by a simple principle. Anything that is thrown at us will be thrown back to its source." In this connection, Leo related to me that when he owned some petrol stations in 1974, a man was filling up his car when another customer asked him about UFOs. Leo joined in the ensuing conversation, relating some of his own experiences. The customer, a recently retired Army colonel, revealed an incident that had occurred in the U.S. Southwest. "We had 240 guys out in the desert and we tried to shoot down our craft," he said. "But they returned every shell back into the guns." This man had just retired, Leo told me. He would not talk dates. The colonel advised Leo not to reveal what he had said. 16. Barry Potter independently confirmed this story, adding that the rounds fired reversed direction in flight and returned to the guns they were fired from, where apparently they exploded, killing troops on the ground. 17. Those soldiers had no choice, they were simply obeying orders. If true, and assuming this was the same group which contacted Leo, such an egregious retaliation would seem contrary to their declared ethics. Barry, however, emphasized that this was not quite the case. Leo always maintained that the aliens' concern was with protecting and preserving the planet Earth, not mankind, he told me. He often hinted darkly that the aliens would not hesitate to sacrifice human life to defend their activities or to assure the survival of life on Earth. 18. I should mention here that since the 1940s, a number of craft, evidently of different origin from those encountered by LEO, have successfully been shot down, resulting in the destruction of a large number of our aircraft by alien craft, as reported in my previous book. 19. After we left the ship, LEO continues in his book, we sat on the ground for a while, all seven of us, looking up at the stars, and talking about different things for perhaps another 2 hours. I hope we will see you again, said one of the men, as they bade LEO farewell. It will be quite a while, though, because we are traveling back to our own galaxy. There will be another one of our spaceships traveling about your world, but they will make far fewer landings than we have. They will be more interested in what man is doing in outer space. We separated then with very deep feelings, wrote LEO, and I started back for my car. Light was provided for me all the way back. I was about half a mile from the ship when I began to notice how warm the area around me seemed to be, although it had grown quite cold out. As I approached my car, I heard the motor running. I never understood how or why they had started my car, but it was nice and warm as I climbed into it. LEO Dershak died in April 2007, aged 86 years. In my meetings with him in Helena, Montana, and in subsequent communications, LEO came across as genuine, a no-nonsense man. I also learned that he was very well connected. In his business dealings, LEO proved to be a formidable opponent, Barry Botter told me. I consider being a rough opponent a positive character trait. His competitors saw this primarily in his behavior while estimating, bidding, and completing jobs, for which he often served as what we call a general contractor, overseeing several subcontractors involved in the overall job. LEO did no advertising, relying upon word-of-mouth recommendations from his customers. His philosophy was to do many jobs with a lower profit margin rather than fewer jobs with a high margin, as was common among his competitors. 20. There is a wealth of additional information in LEO Dershak's book. To conclude this chapter, the following is excerpted from the last 2 pages. If their intent is to eliminate humanity, I have no doubt the easiest course would be to step back and allow us to destroy ourselves. Yet they continue to return, year after year, century after century, and work very hard while they are here. We never saw them in the winter months when insects and plant life are dormant. I think part of their work here was related to the study of how we were poisoning the environment in those times. I think they were analyzing the grasshoppers, which eat a large amount of foliage, for chemical poisons in our environment. I know they are very concerned about our nuclear and chemical weapons and our warlike nature. What a problem we must be for them, always threatening the health and safety of this beautiful planet, which is their responsibility to protect. The picture that comes to mind is a crowd of unruly children fighting and playing in a carefully tended garden with no regard for the problems they are causing for the gardener. Plus, Chapter 2, Galactic Guardians. 19-year-old Pierre Manette lived in Orange, Vaucluse, France, at the time of his first encounter with extraterrestrials. This occurred in the small hours one night in July 1951 while cycling home after a visit to his fiancée, who lived in the little village of Courthesne, 8 kilometers from Orange, a 15 to 20 minute journey he made twice a week, on the same days. Manette had the habit of checking the town clocks before leaving and on arrival, to compare his journey time. That night was no exception, he pointed out, and after the normal check I got on my bike, it was 1:30. But this time, something different happened. Something that was to become increasingly common in abduction scenarios reported years later. I was astonished to find myself instantly transported 5 kilometers further on, at the entrance of a large, deep pit of sand and gravel, 10 to 15 meters from the side of the road. Between the road and the pit were a thick hedge, high undergrowth, and bushes. My mind felt blank. I was dazed. Then, like an automaton and as though I was being directed by an irresistible force, I followed the large gravel slope which led down to the right and further into the pit. I don't know why, but I got off my bike and continued on foot. I felt very tired and had the impression that my feet weren't touching the ground, but that was only an impression. I was very calm and relaxed. Little by little, a kind of peace came over me. The further I went on, the more I had the feeling that one has when getting into water for the first time, up to one's shoulders, a gentle pressure on the lungs. And I was short of breath. Then, at a bend in the pit where I moved as though I knew exactly where I was going, I saw a luminescent light about 60 meters in front of me, behind a mound of earth. I kept on and then saw in front of me, 15 meters away, floating between 50 and 80 centimeters above the ground, a disc 15 to 20 meters in diameter, topped with a central bulge in the form of a dome. From top to bottom, the machine must have been about 3 meters high. The disc pulsated with a white silver bluish light, clearly illuminating the walls of the pit 10 meters away. This radiation seemed to radiate from the soul of the metal of which this strange machine was made, with a fascinating beauty, and the metal seemed at the same time to be both material and ethereal, with constant inner movement, almost alive. As I came closer, I noticed that the surrounding noises had dimmed. When I was about 6 meters from the disc, I could no longer hear the noise of traffic. Even at that time of night, there was still traffic, owing to the festival. As I approached, total silence fell. I could no longer hear the crickets or even the sound of my footsteps on the gravel. It was impressive. I felt great, amazed at what I was seeing. I should point out at this juncture that Munnat had no recourse to the Dershak brothers' experiences, which were not published until 2003. The four extraterrestrials, probably because I was so fascinated by the machine, Munnat continued, I had not noticed, in front of it and a little to the side as it still hovered above the ground, four extraterrestrial human beings in tight-fitting catsuits of shiny silver-gray metal which lit up an area of 5 meters around them. I was no more than a few meters away from them and I went calmly toward them. I was no longer aware of my body. Arriving 3 meters in front of these beings, I stopped and looked at them. They were barefoot. They were tall, they must have measured at least 1.85 meters, over 6 feet. They were perfectly proportioned and identical in build. Their hair was blonde white and reached almost to their shoulders. Their faces were beautiful and very refined. They had a light, frank, and gentle expression which I have never seen in Earth people. They were so beautiful, but at that moment I was not sure if they were men or women, since they did not have breasts. But after a brief while there was no doubt, they were certainly men. They gave an impression of great strength and they were built like athletes. Despite that, they were smiling and radiated calmness, gentleness, and goodness. They then raised their arms in my direction, almost horizontally, the palms of their hands turned upwards. They made this movement almost in unison, and in silence. I made a gentle movement backward. I wanted to escape, and shivered from head to toe. They made themselves clear to me without opening their mouths. I heard their thoughts very clearly in my head. It was extraordinarily precise and clear. Moreover, while admitting that in our language we have precise words capable of translating perfectly what was said during this contact, which I now describe as telepathic, the quantity of what was said to me in such a short time, I estimated about half an hour, could not be expressed in our language if we were to speak for 8 hours a day for a year or two. The message given to me were not words but coded thoughts in the form of impulses, for which I could find no words of translation at the time, apart from a few isolated phrases that I could translate instantly, claimed Munnat. The realization of the concepts which were given to me that night did not become apparent to me until 2 years after my contact. Here are a few scattered phrases that I could understand immediately as they were pronounced. We want the best for all living beings, especially if they are not aggressive. Do not come any closer to our vehicle. It is dangerous for human beings not in tune with its wavelength. The vibrations it emits would destroy the cells of your body. This meeting will cause you troubles which will affect your health. You will have nervous problems for a certain time, then that will pass. Later, our conversation will become clear and you will be able to let the people of your planet know what we have told you. but take care not to allow your own concepts to interfere. You are not the only person on your planet to have spoken with us. Unfortunately, most people do not want to speak about us and the others are not believed.